access to the cultural knowledge and know-how that go into good college performance. The money they needed for college was a higher percentage of their family income. They were less likely to have gone to a high school with advanced placement courses. Their pre-college friendship networks were less likely to have been focused on college achievement, and so on. Such findings show how disadvantages tied to race, class, and ethnicity, contingencies of identity, if you will, outside of college, extract a toll on performance in college. These students face a thousand bites, as Massey put it. Still, like all of the Mellon studies, these studies found that stereotype threat had an undermining effect on college achievement that was an addition to the effect of those other disadvantages. This is a poignant fact. It means that even when Black, Latino, and Native American students overcome other disadvantages in trying to gain parity with white and Asian classmates, they face the further pressure of stereotype and identity threats. Even privileged students from these groups have an extra identity-related pressure working against their achievement. The Massey team, however, did find something that alleviated this effect. Black professors. Black and Latino students in these schools experienced virtually no stereotype threat in classrooms where the professor and probably more of the other students were Black and Latino. The effect of critical mass again? As Ted said about the Black students in his African American political science class, it just seemed that with so many more Black students around, they felt freer of identity threat. Stereotype threat, then, does affect the academic performance of minority students in real colleges. That's the point here. I expect that future research will find factors that moderate this effect. Perhaps this pressure is greater in elite schools. Perhaps it's less of a factor for first-generation immigrant minorities who may not be seen as part of the stereotyped group. Perhaps skin color makes a difference. Nevertheless, the results that are in make it clear that identity threat is a significant cause of minority underachievement in American higher education, and is clearly worth fixing, which brings me back to what changed my own experience of graduate school many years ago. 3. I was assigned Thomas Ostrom as my faculty advisor, whose job it was to help me develop into a scientist through a research apprenticeship. Tom was soft-spoken and straightforward, with wispy hair that, when I met him, was in transition from the short hair of the early 1960s to the long hair of the late 1960s. From the vantage point of a new graduate student, he seemed mostly like a priest of scientific rigor. When we talked about research in his office, he often lit a fat white candle positioned prominently on his desk and smiled hopefully. Recall that, at the time, my personality was in full lockdown, especially at school. I did like meeting with Tom, though. He was calm, serious, and nice, but not that personal, which to someone in personality lockdown was rather welcome. He didn't seem worried about my paralysis. Maybe he didn't know what to do about it, or maybe he didn't even notice it. He didn't seem to focus on me. Rather, in the candlelight, it was the research that got his attention. It would be years before I got any direct praise from him, but his interest in what we were doing together was intense from the beginning. I took a message from this. He had a faith in me as a worthy partner. Somehow, his assumptions about what he was doing as a scientist included me as, at least potentially, a capable colleague. My race and class identities didn't get in his way. If he'd given me praise, I might not have trusted it. So vigilant to threat was I. But I could trust this calm working relationship. My paralysis began to thaw. I teased him about playing the banjo. He pleaded with me that bluegrass music was really great and that I should give it a chance, knowing, beneath his wink, that a kid from Chicago, this wasn't likely to happen. We laughed. My motivation intensified. I became as interested in the research as he. Tom liked that. We'd found an adhesive surface. As this relationship came together, the same cues that had bothered me before, the constant references to who was smart, the near complete absence of minorities in the program or in the field, the faculty member down the hall who used the N-word in class, the evidence that I was of a culture different from that which dominated the setting, bothered me less. I didn't like those things, but they didn't mean I couldn't fit into the field. At the level of the science itself, people could take my work at face value. My advisor did. Tom had no knowledge of stereotype threat, or much knowledge of African-American experience, for that matter. That wasn't the basis of our rapport, which rested rather on a straightforward, nice, but work-focused relationship that functioned like a cue of high critical mass, that is, high numbers of minorities or women in a setting in the experiments that Valerie Purdy Vaughn's, Mary Murphy, and I did. It changed the meaning of the other cues in the situation. Many years later, completely independently, a very thoughtful graduate student named Jeffrey Cohen, a person with a demeanor not unlike Tom Ostrom's, designed an ingenious experiment that actually put the Ostrom strategy of mentoring to an empirical test. 4. Jeff is a social psychologist with an interest both in psychological theory, the understanding of basic psychological processes, and in putting psychology to practical use. As an undergraduate at Cornell, for example, he worked in educational programs for the disadvantaged and spent a semester of overseas studies on social problems and policy in Sussex, England. This side of Jeff led him to a practical and dramatic question. How does a white teacher give critical feedback to a black student so that the feedback is trusted and motivating? One might first ask, why would black students not trust the feedback in the first place? Let's view the situation from their perspective. The mere fact of being black, in light of the stereotypes about it, creates a quandary over how to interpret critical feedback on academic work. Is the feedback based on the quality of their work or on negative stereotypes about their group's abilities? This ambiguity is often a contingency of black students' identity. You might not really believe that an instance of critical feedback stems from stereotyping, or you might not want to believe it, but the possibility can't always be easily dismissed. And this makes the feedback difficult to accept completely. In this way, the quandary can isolate a student from valuable feedback. How do you give constructive critical feedback to students in this quandary? To find out, Jeff, along with Lee Ross, whom I introduced earlier, and I, designed one of the more labor-intensive experiments I've ever been associated with. He brought black and white Stanford students into the laboratory one at a time and asked them to write an essay about their favorite teacher that, if good enough, would ostensibly be published in a new campus magazine on teaching. When they finished, they were told to come back in 2 days to get feedback on the quality of their essay. In that interim, Jeff and his colleagues actually read, grammatically corrected, and developed critical feedback for each essay, a task that over the course of the experiment often kept them up late. When students came back 2 days later, they got critical feedback about their essay delivered in one of three ways. After that, they indicated how much they trusted the feedback and how motivated they were to improve their essay. Two ways of giving this feedback didn't work as well with black students. It didn't work to try to be neutral, nor did it consistently work to preface the feedback with a generally assuring positive statement. Unlike white students, black students didn't trust these forms of feedback, and not trusting them, they weren't motivated to improve their essays. These forms of feedback, after all, could be covering some racial bias. But one form of feedback did work for both black and white students. I will call it the Tom Ostrom strategy. The feedback giver explained that he used high standards in evaluating the essays for publication in the teaching magazine. Still, he said, having read the student's essay, he believed the student could meet those standards. His criticism, this form of feedback implies, was offered to help the student meet the publication's high standards. Black students trusted this feedback as much as white students, and trusting it powerfully motivated them to improve their essay. For black students, the Ostrom style of feedback was like water on parched land, something they rarely seemed to get, but that once they got it, renewed their trust and ability to be motivated by the criticism. Why was it so effective? It resolved their interpretative quandary. It told them they weren't being seen in terms of the bad stereotype about their group's intellectual abilities. Since a feedback giver used high intellectual standards and believed they could meet them, they could feel less jeopardy. The motivation they had always had was released. This would seem to be what Tom Ostrom did for me. By demanding a lot, while at the same time believing I could meet those demands, he interrupted my worried narrative of the setting. And remember, The reason I have this narrative and needed this interruption is that the relevant stereotypes of my group, as well as countless features of the school, projected the idea that I wasn't the kind of person who belonged there. I don't believe I had this view because of some psychic damage that perhaps grew out of my experience of race in the United States, for example. The situation simply made the I don't belong narrative something that was hard for me to dismiss, as Ted's minority status did in his African-American political science class. What I had that Ted didn't have was Tom, someone in a setting whose manner of working with me could change this narrative. Could this be a general strategy for improving the performance of ability-stereotyped groups? To answer that question, you'd have to take the strategy for a spin in the real world and see whether it is powerful enough to actually improve academic performance amid the pressures and complexity of actual college life. 5. Greg Walton was a graduate student of Jeff Cohen's at Yale in the early 2000s. He is now a psychology professor at Stanford. Like Jeff, Greg is a creative, committed scientist with broad interests, one of which is trying out social psychological ideas in the real world to see whether they can cause mountains to tumble into the sea. The question they took on together was this. If you could somehow directly replace a highly vigilant to threat narrative, which might arise naturally from the cues of a college setting, with a narrative that offered a compelling hope about belonging and succeeding in a setting, would that be enough to improve students' college achievement? They devised a simple way to find out. Imagine you are an African-American student and you've been struggling along in your freshman year at a competitive university with a self-narrative of your experience that is much like the one I had during my early days at Ohio State. The place is saturated with cues that raise questions about your fit there. A small number of black and other minority students, few minority faculty and administrators, ethnic studies programs that are seen as of value primarily for minority students rather than for the general student body, an organization of social life that is heavily shaped by race, and so on. Accordingly, your narrative about the situation alerts you to the possibility that this school is not the right place for you to succeed and thrive. Then one day, for a little less than an hour, you are shown the results of a putative survey of upperclassmen that summarizes in narrative form their social experiences at this university. The survey interests you because you want to see what students who are just like you, but a few years ahead of you, have experienced at this school. The results show that upperclassmen felt great frustration during their freshman year, just like you, even deep alienation from the school, and the sense of feeling they would never belong there. But that over time, they gained a sense of belonging and happiness there, thanks to the resources and advantages of the school and the many lasting friendships they'd made there. The narrative conveyed through the survey makes your freshman frustrations look like passing troubles on the way to a hopeful future. Suppose also that you studied these survey results carefully enough to make the narrative a new narrative for your own experience. Would it weaken your vigilance to threat narrative, strengthen your narrative of belonging, and improve your academic performance? When Greg and Jeff did exactly this experiment with freshmen at a Northeastern university, they obtained a heartening result. Black students who got a brief narrative intervention of the sort I just described averaged one-third of a letter grade higher in the next semester than black students in a control group who got the results of a survey about political attitudes rather than about college life. This is a promising result. Think of the long-term effects that a narrative intervention like this might have. If it improves black students' grades in an early college semester, then those better grades could further increase a student's sense of belonging, and that augmented sense of belonging could further improve grades in a mutually reinforcing spiral of a trusting narrative fostering better grades, and better grades fostering a trusting narrative. As of this writing, preliminary follow-up evidence suggests that this may be just what happened. Helping to shape the narratives that stereotype students use to interpret their experience in a school may be a high-leverage strategy of intervening, and there might be multiple ways of doing this. A study that my colleagues Steve Spencer, Richard Nisbet, Mary Hummel, Kent Harbor, and I carried out in the early 1990s at the University of Michigan offers an example of a very different way of affecting narratives. In a dormitory-based academic program, We sponsored late-night bull sessions in which students in groups of no more than 15 talked about topics of personal relevance, relations with parents and family, friendship and romantic concerns, experiences in their classes, fraternities and sororities, and the like. Reflecting the demographics of that university, black students were invariably a small minority of 2, 3, or 4 in these sessions. Yet they benefited most from being there, getting 1/3 of a letter grade higher than black students randomly assigned to control programs that didn't offer such sessions, and achieving close to the same grade point average as white students, those in the program and those in the control programs. Why? Apparently, the late night talk sessions gave black students information they needed to have a more accurate and trusting narrative of their experience. The racial segregation of friendship networks in college life means that when it comes to personal conversations, blacks talk mainly to blacks and whites to whites. Black students, then, might not be able to see that white students have problems similar to their own. And not seeing this, along with being more racially vigilant in light of the broader cues in the setting, they might see race as playing a bigger role in their experience, as something that would sustain greater vigilance toward the racial aspects of their experience. The talk sessions corrected this. They revealed that the stresses of college life, a lower test grade than expected, an unreturned telephone call to a teaching assistant or classmate, an unfriendly interaction with another student, a chronic shortage of cash, and so on, happened to everyone regardless of race. This fact changes black students' narrative. It makes racial identity less central to interpreting experience and increases trust in the university environment. Having a narrative that requires less vigilance leaves more mental energy and motivation available for academic work and thus improved the grades of black students in this program. The idea that modifying the academic narratives of ability stereotype students can improve their real-life grades is illustrated in yet another way by an ingenious study that Joshua Aronson, Kerry Freed, and Catherine Good did several years ago. They wanted to reduce the impact of stereotype threat by subtly teaching black and white Stanford students a more expansive narrative about intelligence. This idea came from the research of the Stanford psychologist Carol Dweck and her students on how our personal theories about ability affect our capacity to take on challenge in school, at work, in sports. Dweck and her students focus on two theories in particular. The incremental theory, which frames the ability required to meet a challenge as learnable and incrementally expandable, and the fixed theory, which frames the ability as a fixed capacity that can't be meaningfully expanded, but they can nonetheless limit one's functioning, the either you have it or you don't theory that many people hold about intelligence. Here's Carol's description of her own sixth grade classroom. My teacher seemed to equate worth with our IQ scores. We were seated around the room in IQ order. If you didn't have a high IQ, she wouldn't let you clean the blackboard erasers, carry the flag in the assembly, or carry a note to the principal. The lower IQ students felt terrible, and the higher IQ students lived in fear that they would take another IQ test and lose their status. It was not an atmosphere that fostered challenge. When a stereotype indicts the intellectual abilities of your group, the implication is that, as a member of that group, you are like the lower IQ students in Carol's sixth grade classroom. You lack a critical fixed ability. It's a narrative that makes any frustration a plausible sign that you can't do the work, that you don't belong there. And it discourages your taking on academic challenges for fear you'd confirm the fixed limitation alleged in the stereotype. The question that Joshua, Kerry, and Catherine asked was whether the impact of stereotype threat could be reduced by giving students a narrative of intelligence as more expandable. Such a narrative would frame academic frustration as a fixable problem rather than as an unfixable limitation, thus reducing the risk involved in confirming the stereotype. They devised a clever way to do this. They asked black and white Stanford students to write letters to ostensible minority elementary school students in East Palo Alto, California, advocating an expandable view of human intelligence. They were given information documenting the expandability of human intelligence, information on the nature of learning, on how the brain changes to reflect learning and experience, and evidence of people making great strides in building intellectual skills. And of course, writing the letter gave them a chance to thoroughly process this narrative. For white Stanford students, not negatively stereotyped in this area, writing the letter had no effect on their subsequent grades. For black Stanford students, however, living under the suspicion of negative ability stereotypes, this changed narrative increased their grades by one-third of a letter grade in the next semester. Sometimes you can give people facing identity threat information that enables a more accurate and hopeful personal narrative about their setting. When this is possible, these intriguing experiments show it improves the academic achievement of people in real colleges. It can put their achievement on very different trajectories. 6. Still, this research was done with strong students admitted to selective colleges. Would reducing identity threat also help the academic performance of ability-stigmatized students in K-12 schooling? Fortunately, we now have some answers to this question. But there is, first, a more basic question. Are young children psychologically sophisticated enough to experience stereotype threat? Can they comprehend some prospect of being negatively stereotyped on the basis of being a girl or being black? As it turns out, I have already presented evidence to this point. Remember the psychologist, Nalini Ambati, who tested the effect of stereotype threat on young Asian girls' math performance in Boston. The girls in the youngest group in her study were 5 to 7 years old. She gave all participants an age-appropriate math test. Gender-related images were evoked for some by having them color in a picture of a girl their age holding a doll just before taking the test. The 5 to 7 year old girls who colored this picture did significantly worse on the test than those who colored in, just before the test, a landscape drawing or a drawing of Asian children eating rice with chopsticks. So there it is. Girls as young as 5 to 7 were thrown off their math performance by a cue as small as an ordinary drawing of a little girl holding a doll. They seemed well able to sense how their group was perceived in math. Also, two Italian researchers, Barbara Muzzotti and Franca Agnoli, found that a similarly incidental cue, passingly presented classroom information that men have been dominant in high-level math, was enough to impair math performance in a sample of Italian girls as young as 10 years of age. And finally, a study by Johannes Keller and his colleagues found that stereotype threat depressed the math performance of sixth grade girls in Germany. Evidence like this shows that young children do seem to have the psychological development needed to experience stereotype threat, at least by 5 or 6 years of age. As it does for adults, it impairs their performance in areas related to the stereotype. Its capacity to do this means that it can have lifelong cumulative effects. For example, deflecting women away from an interest in math before they've had much of a chance to engage it. And how much it does this, the strength of this pressure, seems to depend, as it does for adults, on the density of cues and the setting that evokes stereotypical images. But there is a still stronger way to test the role of identity threat in causing race, gender, and class gaps and test scores among K-12 students. The same way this question was tested in higher education, by means of intervention research. You go into real schools and do something, an intervention that you expect will reduce identity threat among stereotyped students. If nothing happens, and you've done a good job of implementing the intervention, and you've tried it perhaps several times, then identity threat is probably not an important cause of these gaps in that setting. But if what you do makes the gap smaller, then you know that identity threat is a significant cause of these gaps in that setting, and you know one specific thing you can do to reduce those gaps. A number of people I have already introduced, Jeffrey Cohen, Joshua Aronson, Catherine Good, and Carol Dweck, and one person I am about to introduce, Julio Garcia, tried this strategy in what I regard as an extraordinary scientific turn, a revealing series of elegant, sometimes poignant intervention studies in K-12 schooling. 7. Jeff Cohen and Julia Garcia met as graduate students in the social psychology program at Stanford during my first years there. You've met Jeff, but not yet Julio, a Mexican-American who grew up in Sacramento, California, in a middle-class family that owned an avocado ranch in Mexico. Julio has the comfort of a native in both the United States and Mexico, and a psychologist's fascination with human nature. Jeff and Julio left Stanford, began strong research careers, met again, and over a series of conversations, came up with a K-12 intervention idea that both excited and worried them. The idea was based on self-affirmation theory, which, as I described, was developed by an earlier generation of graduate students and me in the 1980s. It posits a basic human motive to perceive oneself as good and competent, in a phrase, as morally and adaptively adequate. When that perception is threatened by events, by how others judge us, or even by our own actions that fail to meet our standards, we struggle to repair that good image. If actual redress fails or isn't possible, we rationalize, we re-explain our actions and other events so as to produce a self-image of competence and morality. The most convincing evidence of this process is that, after a self-image threat, for example, showing a person that he has contradicted himself in an important matter, you can preempt his image-restoring rationalizations by giving him a chance to step back, take a breath, and affirm a larger, valued sense of self. We call this the opportunity to step back, a self-affirmation. Against this larger image of self-integrity, the particular provoking threat seems smaller and less probative, and the person feels less need to rationalize it away. Jeff and Julio reasoned that identity threat is like the self-image threats described in this theory, essentially a threat to a student's sense of being morally and adaptively adequate. Cues in the classroom, like being in a possibly devalued minority group, having a bad stereotype about your group be constantly relevant to the important activities in the classroom, facing a group-based social organization that signals your marginality, can be an ongoing threat to your perceived self-integrity. This is how identity threat is hypothesized to work in real classrooms. It constantly unsettles one's sense of competence and belonging. Thus, their idea. Would simply giving ability-stereotyped students a chance to develop a self-affirming narrative in the situation reduce the threat they feel in the classroom? And if it did, would that improve their performance? Jeff and Julio liked this idea. It made sense theoretically, and if it worked, it would have immense practical value too, offering a broadly useful and inexpensive way to help reduce minority achievement gaps. But could it work? Could something so transient affect something as deeply rooted as minority achievement gaps? To think so was pinning a lot on theory. As I've stressed, minority student achievement gaps have multiple causes, ranging from socioeconomic disadvantage and family dislocation to unsupportive subcultures, and many extensive school reform efforts have failed to make even a dent in these gaps, or to sustain the initial improvements they did achieve. Could a brief self-affirmation then be expected to reduce these gaps? So worried Jeff and Julio. But not so much that they didn't try it out. Now accompanied by Valerie Purdy Vons, whom I introduced earlier, and Nancy Apfel and Allison Master, students working with Jeff, they tested this idea in several racially integrated seventh grade classrooms near Hartford, Connecticut. Close to the beginning of the school year, they asked teachers to give each student in their classroom an envelope with his or her name on it. Instructions in the envelope asked half of the students, randomly selected, to write down their two or three most important values. For example, family relationships, friendships, being good at music, or their religion. And then write a brief paragraph about why these values were important to them. That is, to put these value statements in the form of a personal narrative. This took only about 15 minutes. When they were done, they put the material back in the envelope and handed it to the teacher. In later school terms, they did a few similar follow-up writing exercises. That was it. The other students in these classrooms, the control group, did the same thing, except their instructions asked them to write down their least important values and to explain why others might find them important. These students got a chance to think about values, but no chance to affirm any self-narrative about them. Could the brief self-affirmation affect school performance? It did, dramatically so. The affirmation exercise improved the grades of all but the strongest black students over their performance in the first 3 weeks of school before they did the affirmation. And those with the poorest early performance improved the most. They did better in the class where they made the affirmation and in their other classes too. Other measures showed that the affirmation even reduced how much they thought about the racial stereotypes over the entire semester. The results for the black students in the control condition, those who did no value affirmation, helped reveal what the affirmation did to reduce the gap. It stopped a slide in grades that otherwise would have happened. The grades of the no affirmation control students kept going down, making the racial achievement gap in these classrooms ever wider over the school term. What the affirmation did for the black students who performed it was to stop or slow this decline. In so doing, it reduced the gap with white students by 40% over the term. Just as amazing, follow-up research showed their higher achievement and the smaller gap with white students lasted for at least 2 years. The self-affirmation didn't help white students in this study. The authors explained it this way. We would expect this intervention to improve the performance of all groups of individuals subjected to a threat sufficiently pervasive and intense to impede that entire group's average performance. But their argument goes, whites as a group didn't feel a threat based on their racial identity in this classroom. They might have felt such a pervasive and intense identity threat in an elite basketball camp with lots of black players around, but not in these classrooms where they were a majority. So the apparent power of an affirmation to lift this threat had little effect on their average performance. Lots of people are amazed by these findings, perhaps to the point of doubting them. Okay, they might say, 15 minutes of written reflection on one's self-defining values is probably a good thing. But how could it be enough to improve the grades of minority students in these classrooms, especially when so many more extensive efforts have failed? And how could its effects last for more than 2 years? Such findings are a skeptic's delight, and when you are the scientist who has produced them, all you can really do is try to replicate them, which Jeff, Julio, Valerie, and their students have now done near Boulder, Colorado, with Latino Americans. A replication, however, raises even more the question of how this intervention works. In answer, the researchers offer a two-part explanation. The first part is the self-affirmation idea. With one's larger sense of competence and worth brought into view by the writing exercise, poorer early performance in the semester and other identity-threatening cues in the classroom were less all-important than they would have otherwise have been. This made students less vigilant, freeing up mental resources and improving performance. The second part of their explanation is that better performance interrupts an otherwise negative recursive process, a process that stood out vividly among blacks in the control condition. Without an affirmation, early frustrations and threatening environmental cues worried them more, which worsened their performance, which worried them still more, until a full-scale downward progression was underway. In their words, African Americans, a stereotyped group, displayed greater psychological vulnerability to early failure, and I would add, to other identity-threatening cues as well. For them, early failure may have confirmed that the stereotype was in play as a stable global indicator of their ability to thrive in school. By shoring up self-integrity at this time, the affirmation helped maintain their sense of adequacy and interrupted the cycle in which early poor performance influenced later performance and psychological state. If this audiobook reveals anything, it's that understandings evolve with continued research. This will surely be so for the processes underlying the affirmation project. What social psychologists call moderators of the affirmation effect will doubtless emerge. Factors without which the salutary effect of affirmation on minority student grades won't happen. For example, perhaps affirmation will help grades in good schools with good instruction, but not in poor schools with poor instruction. The authors stressed that the success of their intervention depended on good teaching and resources being in place in these schools. Reducing identity threat, they suggest, simply increased black students' access to that instruction. If quality instruction hadn't been available in these schools, affirmation might have had little effect. Or perhaps affirmation will help grades in integrated schools where identity threat is more of a factor, but not help grades as much in more identity homogeneous schools where identity threat is less of a factor. I wonder, for example, about all-girl schools or minority and low-income schools where virtually everyone shares the ability stereotyped identity in question. Stereotype students may feel less likely to be judged and treated stereotypically in schools like these. This said, the present findings make an important point. A psychological intervention that leaves minority students less susceptible to negative stereotypes about their group's abilities can significantly improve their performance in real schools for a long time. Identity threat isn't a passing threat that happens just on tests. It's a cloaking threat that can feed on all kinds of daily frustrations and contextual cues and get more disruptive over time. The fate of Black control group students shows how profound these social psychological pressures are in real life. For integrated schools like the ones in these studies, the cloaking effects of identity threat can be a big part of the racial achievement gap, and reducing this threat is a necessary part of the solution. If you take the intervention of Jeff, Julio, Valerie, and their colleagues as proof that something that does nothing more than reduce identity threat can improve performance by ability stereotype students, even for a long while, then you might want to know that it can be done in other practical ways. And fortunately, it can. Catherine Good and Joshua Aronson tested whether Carol Dweck's type of coaching, encouraging the view that abilities are expandable, could, by reducing the impact of stereotype threat in school, increase the grades and test scores of ability stereotype students. They randomly selected a sample of low-income and minority students from the entering class of a rural Texas junior high school, and assigned each of these students a college student mentor who advised them academically over the year, meeting with them twice and emailing them regularly. For one group of mentees, the mentors stressed the expandability of intelligence, regularly explaining how the brain makes new neural connections when it learns new things, and exposing them to a restricted website that showed illustrations of brain dendrites growing when a person tries to solve hard problems. Another group of mentees engaged in similar activities, but theirs were focused on drug abuse prevention rather than on the expandability of intelligence. Which group performed better? The Texas Assessment of Academic Skills, TAAS, was given at the end of the school year. Both girls and boys, whose mentors had focused them on the expandability of intelligence, did significantly better on the reading section of this test than those who had focused on drug abuse prevention. But the biggest effect of the intelligence is expandable message was for girls on the math section of the TAAS, the part of the test on which they would likely have experienced the greatest stereotype threat. Among students whose mentoring had focused on drug abuse prevention, girls scored significantly lower on this section of the TAAS than did boys, reproducing the typical gender gap in math performance. But among students who focused on the expandability of intelligence, girls performed at the same level as the boys on this section, completely eliminating the usual sex difference on the test. 8. These studies show that affirmations, incremental mindsets, and the like can steer ability stereotype students in K through 12 into self-narratives that, like mine at Ohio State, deflate the threatening meaning of environmental cues. One might then ask, as my wife Dr. Dorothy Steele did, whether you could find further techniques for doing this if you studied the behavior of teachers who, compared to their colleagues, were especially good with ability stereotype students. Would their practices reveal a strategy for creating identity safety and improving grades? Eventually, she talked a number of us, including Hazel Marcus, a leading social psychologist and pioneering founder of modern cultural psychology, Paul Davies, whom I introduced earlier, Amanda Lewis, an esteemed educational sociologist at Emory University, who was visiting Stanford as this project began, Francis Green, a top-flight research manager, and me. And to helping her conduct a study of this question in the elementary school classrooms of Richmond, California, where most students have one or another ability stereotyped identity, where specifically the breakdown of student ethnicities was 33% Latino, 32% African Americans, 17% white, and 12% Asian, and 6% other ethnicities, and where the vast majority of students came from low-income families. The study plan was simple. We would observe teachers in their classrooms and measure as many of their practices and as many features of their classroom culture as we could, and then see which practices and features enabled their students to feel more identity safety and to perform better on year-end standardized tests. Trained observers, not informed about identity safety, observed third and fifth grade teachers in 84 classrooms and 13 Richmond elementary schools. Each teacher was observed three times during the year and rated on a variety of scales, such as positivity of relationship with students, child-centered classroom decision-making, use of high expectations and academic rigor, degree of stress on fundamental skills, teacher skill, and teacher restrictiveness, 19 scales in all. A distinct constellation of teacher practices and classroom features emerged that fostered identity safety and better performances on year-end tests. The effect of this constellation was somewhat stronger in the fifth grade than in the third, but it included the same things in both grades. Positive relationships with students, more child-centered teaching, use of their diversity as a classroom resource rather than following a strict strategy of colorblindness, teacher skill, warmth and availability, and so on. Interestingly, top-down decision-making with a stress on basic skills didn't work well in these schools. In Dorothy's words, the effective, identity-safe practices avoid cues that might instantiate a sense of stereotype threat in students and are, instead, aimed at making everyone in the class feel as valued and contributive regardless of their ethnic group or gender. 9. At this point, then, accumulating research shows that reducing identity threat or its impact in integrated K-12 schools improves the academic performance of ability stereotype students as it did for ability stereotype students at the college level. The benefits are sizable, reliable, and often long-lasting, and the interventions themselves are low-cost and relatively easy to do. Their cohering principle is straightforward. They foster a threat-mitigating narrative about one's susceptibility to being stereotyped in the schooling context. And though no single one-size-fits-all strategy has evolved, the research offers an expanding set of strategies for doing this. Establishing trust through demanding but supportive relationships, fostering hopeful narratives about belonging in the setting, arranging informal cross-group conversations to reveal that one's identity is not the sole cause of one's negative experiences in the setting, representing critical abilities as learnable, and using child-centered teaching techniques. More will be known in the years ahead, but what we know now can make a life-affecting difference for many people in many important places. Still, one might ask, how central should reducing identity threat be in efforts to help students with substantial skill and knowledge deficits relative to those of other students at their school? Schools sometimes admit students who have strong intellectual potential, but who lack the educational background of other students at the school. Can efforts to reduce identity threat suffice to help these students? No, would be my answer. Reducing identity threat is not sufficient to overcome real skill and knowledge deficits in school. To do that, students have to have the opportunity to acquire the relevant skills and knowledge. They need good instruction and the chance to apply themselves to critical material, sometimes for long periods of time. But it's equally true that for ability stereotype students, reducing identity threat is just as important as skill and knowledge instruction. It may not be sufficient, but it is necessary. That is, no amount of instruction, no matter how good it is, can reduce these deficits if it doesn't also keep identity threat low. Without that, threat will always have first claim on students' attention and mental resources. So neither approach, providing instructional opportunities or reducing identity threat, is sufficient by itself to improve academic performance, especially for ability stereotype students. Both are necessary. That said, the intervention studies bear a profound lesson. Even though group underachievement problems may be rooted in background factors that are difficult to change, socioeconomic disadvantage, poorer access to good schooling, less parental support, low participation in social networks that enable the timely development of critical skills and cultural capital, historically rooted patterns of sexual socialization, and so on. Remedying the immediate causes of these problems and the situations in which they occur can improve things dramatically. Heart attacks also have background causes that are difficult to change. Genetic history, long-term habits of diet and exercise, smoking, life stress, etc. Nevertheless, the likelihood of a heart attack can be greatly reduced by drugs and surgery. They do nothing to counter the background causes of heart disease. They treat the most immediate cause of a heart attack, blocked coronary arteries. There were many difficult-to-change background factors that caused me distress in my early days at Ohio State. My different racial and social class background, the absence of a critical mass of other minority students, and so forth. You couldn't change these things or change them easily, and so you could think there was nothing to be done for me. It wouldn't seem that a trusting relationship with a mentor, a white mentor at that, would make a difference. It wouldn't fix the things causing my troubles, but the point here is that it might reduce the troubles themselves. And beyond this hope, the research of this chapter offers two strategies for reducing identity threat. First, realizing that this threat arises from cues in a setting that signal possibly threatening contingencies of identity, one can try as best as possible to eliminate those real contingencies and the cues that signal them. You can become alert to how the features of a setting affect people and change them so that they don't disadvantage certain groups. For the sake of the few over 40 types working in that Silicon Valley startup firm that I visited, maybe all of the music wouldn't have to be the indie rock and hip-hop preferred by the under 25-year-olds. For the sake of minority students in college, perhaps the curriculum considered core, and thus of foundational value for all students, could include in-depth material reflecting the history and perspective of multiple groups in American society. Second, the intervention studies show that when the effort to change identity-relevant cues and contingencies in a setting can go no further, helping people understand the safety they do have in a setting is immensely valuable, academically valuable, and they demonstrate intriguing ways of doing it, ways that I hope will be suggestive. 10. The intervention studies were done to test whether reducing stereotype threat, or the subjective sense of it, would improve real-life grades. As they began to accumulate, however, Greg Walton and Stephen Spencer saw that these students could also be used to examine two other questions. Whether stereotype threat is a significant cause of stereotype students' underperformance in real schools, and whether our traditional measures of academic potential, for example, the SAT might, at least under some circumstances, underestimate the potential of stereotype students. Addressing these questions brings the research of this book full circle. It was the puzzle of minority student underperformance that started this research. Greg and Steve saw that answering these questions boiled down to deciding between two scenarios of how identity threat affects an earlier test performance and the later grade performance it is used to predict. The events of both scenarios are the same. Imagine you are a black high school student applying to college. You take the SAT, you score less well than you'd hope to, but because your score is okay and you have other strengths, you get into a competitive college. In college, however, your grade performance is again lower than you expected. Lower, in fact, than was predicted by your SAT. That is, lower than other students with the same SAT score. In other words, you underperform in college. The events are the same, but the interpretation of what caused them is where the two scenarios differ. In scenario one, stereotype threat doesn't much affect your earlier test performance or your later college grades. The prior test, or prior grades, is a valid assessment of potential for people of all identities. Individual and group differences in performance on it are assumed to reflect individual and group differences in underlying academic skills and knowledge. And the reason a group might underperform in college is assumed to be something like the lesser motivation of its members. In scenario two, Both the earlier test performance and your college grades are depressed by stereotype threat. Thus, the earlier test performance underestimates your true potential, not necessarily because of biased content, but because of the interfering pressure of stereotype threat during the test. And what happens when you get to college in the scenario is that escalating identity threat in the college environment drives your performance even lower than that underestimation would have predicted. Which scenario is correct? The first scenario has the fact of black student underperformance on its side. If a prior test, like the SAT, underestimates your true potential because of stereotype threat, then your true higher potential might be expected to shine through in later coursework, meaning that your later grade should be higher than those of non-stereotype students who got the same SAT scores you got. But this doesn't happen. Black student underperformance, as you know, shows that black students don't typically get higher subsequent grades than non-stereotype students with the same SATs. They typically get lower subsequent grades than these non-stereotype students. So, in scenario one, the prior test, the SAT in this example, didn't underestimate your potential. If anything, it overestimated your potential, since you never got grades as high as it predicted. Greg and Steve's realization was that you could actually test empirically which scenario was correct, at least for the sample of students who had participated in the intervention studies designed to reduce stereotype threat. All you would need for these students was their earlier test scores and the college grades they earned while in the program. If stereotype students got better subsequent grades than non-stereotype students when they were in an intervention program, then scenario two would be supported. For example, if alleviating stereotype threat in college led stereotype students to overperform there in comparison to non-stereotype students, it would mean that their underperformance in more typical college environments was likely due to the stereotype threat in those environments depressing their grades. It would also suggest that the earlier test of their potential, say the SAT, underestimated their true potential since they actually got higher grades than the test would have predicted when stereotype threat was reduced in their later college environment. Higher grades than non-stereotype students with the same SAT scores, for example. But if stereotype students continued to get worse grades than non-stereotype students in a program that reduced stereotype threat at their school, it would mean that stereotype threat had no effect on either their school grades or their earlier test performance. It would mean that scenario one was correct. A clear test was on. Greg and Steve gathered the intervention studies for which they could get participants' prior test scores or prior grades as a non-test measure used to predict later school performance and subsequent grade performance during the intervention. Greg and Jeff study at the University in the Northeast, Jeff, Julio, Valerie, and their student studies in the grade schools of New Haven and Boulder, and the study my colleagues and I did at the University of Michigan. The results were clear. Scenario 2 carried the day. In these interventions, stereotype students consistently got better subsequent grades than non-stereotype students with the same prior test scores or grades. They not only didn't underperform, they overperformed. In science, one must be cautious. Maybe these interventions did something in addition to reducing stereotype threat that led stereotype students to perform so well. I can't think of what that could be. Certainly not something that could explain the full pattern of their results. Further research will, of course, be more penetrating. But having gestured to caution, several things are especially impressive about these findings. Considering how modest these interventions were, their impact was dramatic. They show that, at least in these samples, even modest attempts to reduce this threat totally eliminated the classic pattern of minority student underperformance, a strong indication that this underperformance was being caused by stereotype threat. They also suggest that the earlier taken measures of potential used to predict later performance, such as the SAT and the college-level interventions, and prior grades used in Jeff, Julio, and Valerie's middle school intervention, were themselves biased. That is, stereotype threats suppressed the performance of stereotype students on these measures, causing these measures to underestimate the potential of stereotype students, a potential that got revealed, and a later school environment that reduced this threat. Nor are these passing findings. The studies in Greg and Steve's analysis included students of different ages, both K through 12 and college-age students, several different strategies for reducing stereotype threat, and many hundreds of student participants in all. These findings show the cumulative effect of stereotype threat as an identity contingency on the intellectual development over time of an entire group of ability-stereotyped people. And it shows what to do about it, that environments can be feasibly modified to allow ability-stereotyped students the kind of unencumbered engagement with academic work needed to fulfill their potential. This research journey has been long, and it's far from over, but it has reached a marker. A preponderance of evidence strongly suggests that underperformance, when not caused by discrimination against a group in grades, is likely caused by stereotype and identity threats and the interfering reactions they cause. It also suggests that tests used to measure students' potential for some subsequent level of schooling under a common set of testing conditions can underestimate the actual potential of stereotype students. This effect has been difficult to discern because the subsequent grade performance of these students is also depressed by stereotype threat, this time in the schooling environment itself. That these threats cause something as lawfully observed in American society as minority student underperformance means that they are as common as crabgrass and just about as unruly. Still, a hope arises from this research. If we want to overcome underperformance, if we want to open the door for many stereotyped students to learn and prosper in society, we should, in addition to focusing on skill and knowledge, also focus on reducing these threats in schools, classrooms, workplaces, even basketball gyms. You should focus on making the identity less inconvenient, and this first era of intervention studies makes a good beginning in showing you how to do it. But doing this requires that we Americans come together across identity lines. We have to engage integrated settings to improve them. Yet to do that, we all may have to overcome still another form of identity threat, a form that, if ignored, would leave any understanding of the role these processes play in the larger society incomplete, a form to which our research next turned. Chapter 10. The Distance Between Us, the Role of Identity Threat. 1. In her illuminating book, The Failures of Integration, Cheryl Cashin shares a private joke that she and her husband, both African Americans, have about flights on Southwest Airlines, which allows passengers to board on a first-come, first-served basis. If they arrive late, they hope for what they call Southwest Airlines First Class. They hope that a young, dark-skinned African-American male will be toward the front of the line and will take one of the comfortable, exit-advantaging seats toward the front of the plane when he boards. Cashin says, at least 4 out of 5 times, we can depend on the seats next to that black person being empty, even if his row is far up front, begging for the taking. I am always happy to take this convenient seat, feeling grateful for the discomfort of others and marveling at the advantage they are willing to pass up due to their own social limitations. I smile warmly at my black brother as I plop down next to him. What causes the Southwest Airlines first class? Is it due entirely to the prejudice of white passengers, a racial aversion, perhaps to being close to a black passenger? Or is it caused, in some part, by the predicament of identity that is at the center of this book? The same predicament that I suggested bottled up Ted in his African-American political science class? These possible causes of the Southwest Airlines first class are different, with different implications for what you do to reduce the tension and distance between groups. The identity threat explanation doesn't require attributing prejudice to the white passengers. All one need assume, it says, is that they have a worry like Ted's. The risk of saying, doing, or even thinking something that would make them feel racist or like they could be seen as racist in interacting with the black passenger. It takes the perspective of the person whose actions one is trying to explain. The woman or minority taking the math test, for example, or in this case, the perspective of the white passengers passing up the seat next to a black passenger. It assumes, in light of present-day norms of civility, that most of these passengers are invested in not appearing as racist. It further assumes that this investment, ironically, may lead them to avoid situations like the seat next to the black passenger, or more importantly, in light of the issues raised in the last chapter, to avoid teaching in a minority school or taking on a minority student mentee. In keeping Americans apart, this identity pressure might make people less interested in the strategies of intervention described in that last chapter.